directs your actions, so that you're moving, use that to get action going, which moves you there. But then finally you have to give up the desire. See, for me, for example, I haven't the remotest idea whether I'm going to realize that inner being permanently now or in 10 lives or whenever. I haven't any idea, and it doesn't even matter to me. All I can do is do what I do each day. I haven't any time dimension going any longer. It's really quite irrelevant to me, actually.
But if you sit and you, not you, you, anybody, yeah, myself, put myself in a meditative position and purposely say to myself, in, out, or up, down, and count purposely so that I should attain this particular state of meditation, will you?
If the technique is good, it will take you beyond that meta thought of I am doing this in order to attain. Like you start the breathing thing in order to do that. But then, you, in order to do it correctly, you have to be concentrating on the breathing thing. And pretty soon that takes you over and starts to calm you, and that directs your mind. In other words, the vrittis, or the waves on the ocean, become just full of rising, falling. They become repetitive and repetitive, and then your mind calms down. You see? It is a form of hypnosis. Well, I don't know. Hypnosis has other implications to it about directiveness, which this doesn't have. It is a form of putting a repeated pattern into the system to calm it down, yeah.
People seem to have such a capacity to block, you know, block out awareness and block out things. And there's been an emphasis in what you've been saying that somehow the our techniques are almost mechanical and somehow can carry us through. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that what's happening when you speak in that way, or that the trap that people can get into if they think in that way, is that somehow they will think that there is something external to themselves that they can do, you know, rather than what the great question always is, which is changing oneself, you know. I think, have you been underestimating this block, or do you, you know, what's your thinking on this? Or could it just be that in a society such as ours, the whole vocabulary is so foreign, or the experience is so foreign to so many people,
yeah,
that we haven't the whole mental set to go at it right?
If you yeah, Jung says this very well in the eulogy to the guy that wrote Secret of the Golden Flower, about being able to conceive of the Western model, Eastern model, by changing your whole orientation to be able to understand it. But the method, if the method is strong enough and you do it regularly enough, it puts you into another place from which to view the scene, from which vantage point the block is less relevant. You divest the block of the energy. See, the block, the way a block works is you take energy from the expression of the thing and then you use it to suppress the thing,
right,
or repress the thing, right? Now, if you just take this whole area and leave it all blocked up, see, and then just keep converting energy to this other thing, which then that starts to undercut only by de-emphasizing it. It de-emphasizes it.
It's like, in a sense, it has less of a grip on
it's
you.
Like growing out of puberty, you know. It's like going beyond adolescence. The things that were so important just cease to be important. It's not that they get solved, they just cease to be that important.
So it has less of a grip on you. Like,
yeah. Now, I am looking at it, and I'm talking from a point of view of my own sadhana, which is a total push sadhana. You see, in other words, it may be that you can never use a method in a part-time basis that will be powerful enough to supplant the power of the cognitive model that the West reinforces at every turn.
Right.
I mean, you realize the whole economic stability of the society is based on desire. It's based on supporting and enhancing and creating new social desire. And so you can't look at television, you can't talk to hardly anybody, and that's why they say, why Buddha says, the three things you want are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The image of the realized being is Buddha, the Dharma is the method, and Sangha is the community of spiritual beings. And if you don't have them, hang out by yourself. Because if you hang out around worldly people, you become a worldly person. Because it's so subtle the way that, because they are the masters of subtlety, because that's been the game to create the desire to keep the economy going.
The other way I had used sex, besides for the social aspects of it, was what I called in my naivete, I was calling tantric practices. That is, using the external world or the world of desire to go beyond desire. Well, any Westerner that thinks he can do with sex is a better man than I am, I'll tell you. Because if you start, it's one thing. I'll give you an example with food. Here's a good example. I'm a very oral guy. I was brought up in a Jewish middle-class family where, you know, where food is love. It's just a very simple equation. There's no, you know, it's not a function of anything else. Just love, food, love. Thanksgiving, big turkeys, it's all very clear. And I can remember all the meals, and that's where the love, oh boy. Right? I was always overweight and so on. It was always a big hustle for me, a hassle. It was their hustle, my hassle. All right, now I'm sitting there with my bowl of rice. Well, now, the bowl of rice is certainly not brisket and tzimmis and all the things I'm used to, see? But it doesn't matter to me because I have such a thing about food that it could be practically anything, and I'll just get into it like I'm climbing into a hot bath, you know? I mean, it's just, it's food, right? And I've got a special world for food. You just enjoy the feeling of it going down your gullet and the, you know, and oh, and the full and, oh, all those feelings, right? Desire, 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 desire everywhere. Okay, I don't mind giving up. I'm sitting in an ashram. There are no women around. I don't mind giving up sex. I don't mind giving up warmth. I don't mind any of those things. Everything's pretty cool. I don't mind giving up books and all that. But food, the delight of eating food, they're not going to take away from me, see? They and me. Right? Well, I wrestled with this for quite a while. And I'm told that on Mangalam, on Tuesday, don't take food until nightfall. We fast on Tuesday. All right, every Yom Kippur, when I was a Jew, I fasted, it's all right. But when you're a Jew in Yom Kippur and you fasted, you thought about food all afternoon, you know, in preparation for eating. And now, of course, it's every Tuesday we'll fast, okay? Right? It wasn't very painful. So I fasted Tuesday, and then Wednesday, the guy that made the lunch was away 1 week, and so no lunch came. And I got, you know, like, if I had had a watch, it would have been that kind of operation. And so I figured, well, this must be some lesson I'm being taught, so I go without food. So I had my milk at night, I didn't even notice it. So the next day I said to Haridas Baba very proudly, ego, you know, the great thing about your ego, it's so cute. It's so cute. Just when you think you've done something, it walks around behind you and pats you on the back and says, good, you know, and there it is again, you know. That's ego. So I said to Haridas Baba the next day, well, I went 2 days without eating, and I didn't even notice it. I wrote on my chalkboard. He said, well, why don't you keep on? He said, it's the new moon. He says, it is a good practice to give your intestines a rest and to increase your health, and it is good for discipline. It's tapas. On the new moon, it is good to fast for 9 days. Okay. All right. You know, I can bathe in the river, but I got all, you know. Well, after about the fourth day, I'm like dizzy and, you know, you take water, right? I took tea in the morning. I was chickened out a little bit. Tea was my one luxury I never gave up. I mean, I gave up coffee and smoking and drugs, and all, although nobody told me to, but I took tea once a day. Now, after the fifth day, I started to cease to notice it. And then by the eighth day, it was just perfectly great. And I was very high. Oh, boy, was I just, oh. My head was so clear, and I was feeling so good. By the ninth day, during those 9 days, I was having fantasies at night. And I would dream of turkey dinners, and I would dream of steaks at Original Joe's in San Francisco, and lobster Savannah at Lockover's in Boston, and, you know, and French restaurants in New York. And I, you know, I had all of my gourmet, because I used to, I mean, I was so high, I used to get Gourmet Magazine, you know, and cook all those things, you know. I mean, I was so trapped by the subtle sphere. That's what it is. It's the subtle sphere, the sphere of the senses. And I was so into it. And so the fantasy is just like, and I taste the stuff, you know, and I was just eating it all the time. And of course, who was I fooling, you know? And I'd go to see the guru. Like, if I'd be at my room and I'd dream about something in America, the next day, if I happened to be brought to the guru, which didn't happen often, I didn't see him very often at all, he'd say, "You were in America last night." Right? He checked in at where my head was, and, you know, it was somewhere else. Right? So there's no hiding. I mean, there's no, all right. So the first fast, I was full of turkeys and all that stuff. By the second 9-day fast, the second time I did this, now my fantasies were only of things I could eat there. So I'd start a fantasy, big bowls of spinach with lemon. In other words, I kept the oral thing. I had just narrowed it to, you know, I had, because I knew now I was going to probably be vegetarian for the rest of my life. I mean, it looked, they said it will take you 3 years to completely convert your body. And the argument behind vegetarian thinking for them, I'm doing it because I'm told to do it. I mean, people come and say, "What is your theory about diet?" And I've gotten into so many hassles about that. I remember Newsweek magazine quoted me as saying about the macrobiotic diet, "Well, it gets you high." Which, and then people were dying, and, you know. So I don't, there are so many diet attitudes like this. I take dairy products, and macrobiotics keeps you away from dairy products, and so on. But the diet is designed to, well, I can best explain that to you by the next category in Yama, which is non-killing. Their thinking is that you emit a set of, that we are aware of one another at many other levels than at the gross body level. And we emit what you might call vibrations, or finer stuff, if you will, than gross body things. They're not available to our gross senses. Just like some people see auras in other people. Right? And these vibrations are determined by what you are, and what you eat, and what you think, and what you feel. Now, the problem is, if you're going to sit in a room for 10, 12 hours not moving, if you eat foods which contain, just imagine this following process, which is not unreasonable. An animal is killed. At the moment of death, it goes through a very violent experience, and it releases a lot of adrenaline and a lot of the kind of endocrine material into the cells that are connected with action. When you eat that and make that part of your body, when you then call upon your cells, when you're working, when you get subtle enough in your senses so that you are in tune with your body is giving you the message of what you have eaten, literally. And the argument that they present is that you cannot afford to eat highly spiced foods that will arouse your sexual passions or that part of your endocrine system. You can't afford to eat foods that are connected with violence in any way. You just can't afford it. And like the teacher says, there are other things that are just wonderful, living with jungle sadhus. The teacher says, snakes know heart. Right? Meaning, a snake knows where you're at. See, if you live in the jungle, you live in a different world than you do in the, you know, in the jungle of New York City. And in that jungle, that's why you see these pictures of saints sitting with wild animals all around them, because they can sit with wild animals all around them, because they don't set off any of the vibrations that make animals fear them. And so I don't wear or eat anything connected with animals. Even the sandals I have, they come from the Gandhi ashram, which is very funny. They make leather sandals out of cows that died naturally. So that when a cow dies naturally in Delhi, you call up the Gandhi ashram and they send over a truck and they take the skin and they make sandals out of it. And those you can wear because that's does different vibration. All right, so I'll later tell you how I got out of the diet problem, or the food problem, because it involves meditation. Will leave me with my fantasies of spinach. Non-stealing, another one of Yama things, not taking anything that doesn't belong, that belongs to someone else, which is logical because it just creates bad. That's like a social rule. It's like a commandment. And then that's brahmachari, truth, or non-lying, non-stealing, non-killing. And the final one is not taking possessions, not receiving. It's called not receiving gifts. And what it means, as close as I can feel it, is not to have any attachment to any possessions. And when people give you something, which I'm giving it to you, and you say, I am accepting it, coming along with all of that are all of the things that come with the contract you're making with that other human being. And you get a lot more than the gift, as you all know who have been in the gift giving and receiving. Very few things are given without attachment. And the only thing you can receive is something that is given without attachment. You can receive anything if it's given without attachment. You can use anything if you use it without attachment. But if you are attached to it, then the littlest thing is too much. Now, that's part of that renunciation matter again. And it is also one of the basic requirements of pursuing sadhana, or the spiritual path, is the state of virag, it's called, V-A-I-R-A-G, virag, or non-attachment, or being done with it all. And that's part of why I had to tell you about all of that early stuff that was happening to me, about the Mercedes and the motorcycle and all that stuff. Because I was very, very fortunate, you see, in that by the time I was like 28 or 9 years old, I had pretty much had what society had to offer, what Western society had, what the great society was going to give. I had one of the greatest academic jobs. I had all the material possessions I could want. And I saw in my heart that that wasn't where it was at. And that's what virag is. You see, now if you're lucky and you're born, you're a very high person and you're in a very high reincarnation, you're born with that virag. You never feel any attachment to things. You use them always and you don't care about them. But most people, and I analyzed, I made charts while I was in India about the onset of virag towards different things. And there were some things like attachments to, you know, like fame and power and sex and security and things like that that I wasn't finished with yet. I just had to recognize I wasn't done with yet. But virag is one of the prime requirements, and you can assess in your own life where you're at in relation to that. Because you can have everything as long as it doesn't matter. As long as it doesn't matter to you. You know, I can get into my father's new Cadillac and go zooming down the road and break up. It's the funniest thing I've done in weeks, you know. Because it doesn't make the least bit of difference. When I'm walking barefoot in India, it's the same state. Because you finally realize that what you're doing is you're developing a place inside where you live, which makes all of that irrelevant. All of that irrelevant. Niyama is cleanliness, first thing, internal and external cleanliness. And it's a little difference. The hippie scene in America has gotten so much of, you see, America has gotten to be a whole deodorant and plastic floor-covering type culture so much. Everything is so protected to be cleaner and cleaner and cleaner and cleaner that the way and the form in which rebellion takes its way for a kid that was brought up in that is, you know, I won't bathe, or I'll just, you know, those things aren't important. And it's very interesting that the yogis in India are very clean people, extremely clean people. I mean, they really, except for ones that are in special sects where, but even that, dirt isn't the same thing as it is to us, because they'll clean their hair with ashes, see, which we would call dirty, but they use it as a cleaning process to keep the lice out and keep the oils and so on. So there is a lot of concern with keeping your body clean. It's like the theory is this is the temple in which your spirit resides, and it's temple maintenance. You got to take care of the temple. Now, there are a lot of other things I learned, by the way, which are very interesting, like going to the toilet squatting, right? Also, the left and the right hand. You wipe yourself with water, with a lota, after you finish going to the toilet, with your left hand, right? And you eat with your right hand. And these are just the way, I'm left-handed, so I was nearly in a bad bind. You know, they said, don't stick your left hand in the food bowl, or you'll have to get it taken off. It's a very bad social etiquette thing. Now, what happened to me was somebody who had been brought up in this antiseptic world that we live in, you know, you don't touch your feces. What kind of thing is that? You know, and don't get your hands out of the food. What do you think silverware is for? Suddenly to be, you know, this business of picking up the food and like this and cleaning myself and getting back, it was like coming back into my biological foundation, if you will. I mean, it felt very natural. And now I still maintain all these habits here in the United States. On toilet bowls, I sit on the seat. Stand on the seat, and it's very good for your intestines and things like that, too. And I eat by myself in my cabin in New Hampshire, where I live, in my little cabin, and I eat with my hands. I make my own food, because when food is cooked, the vibrations of the cook, when there's fire involved, enter the food. That's why I can't eat in restaurants. I mean, I've got to explain to you that I can talk with you at great length about what we can adapt from what I've learned for the Westerner living in the world, living as a grusta, as a householder. But what I'm telling you now is what it's like to go on the total trip, if you will, of a renunciate who has been, as you can see, a very worldly guy. You know? And what you give up and what it means. And what it, you know, like ice cream has a gelatin base, I find out, and gelatin is made of cow's intestines.
WBAI New York.
It's the end of ice cream, unless you make your own.
No hamburger stands, you know, none of that, of course. What do you understand all? All right. Now, the other parts of niyama are very important. One of them is contentment. The Book of Tao says, once be content. You know that one in the Tao that says, starts out with, when the way exists, coach horses fertilize the fields. When the way does not exist, when the way does not exist, war horses breed in the parks. That's the line, right? And the end of that is, once be contented. Once know contentment, and you will always be so. And the idea is, whatever the situation is, you're content with it. You just experience contentment. You just let it happen. This is it. This is the way it is. Right. You must differentiate between what is called internal freedom and external freedom first. To the extent that you have internal freedom, then you do karma yoga. That is, you do the thing out in the world that is best suited to your capacities and your skills. And you do the thing which is most going to help other people with their opportunities to be liberated also. To the extent that you do not have internal freedom, anything you think you are doing in the outside world is probably not what you're doing at all. For example, if you don't like a condition that exists in the world, and you protest against it. If a little analysis from one level up indicates that you create the polarization, that in the sense, and this I'm shortcutting a whole long lecture to tell you this, that just the hippies produce the police just as the police produce the hippies. I mean, in other words, only to the extent that you can protest with no attachment can you protest without creating vibrations which create the opposite of what you try to create. For example, if you read the Bhagavad Gita, this talks specifically to this topic, right? Now, there are levels at which you look at suffering. See, let us take, just for a moment, let us digress to take Buddha's Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth says, all life is suffering, birth is suffering, growing old is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, getting what you don't want is suffering, not getting what you do want is suffering. All suffering, right? Suffering in life. Second of the noble truths is, the cause of suffering is craving. That is, it is your desires. If you didn't desire anything, you couldn't suffer from not getting it. If you didn't desire life, you wouldn't suffer about death. Suffering is the result of desire, in the sense that. Third noble truth is, to give up suffering, you give up craving. I remember talking to Emmett Grogan, who was the head of the Diggers at one time. And he was in New York, and he was trying to turn the Puerto Ricans on, he said. That was his statement. But they didn't want to be turned on. Because they hadn't yet gone on the middle class trip, as he put it. I'm just giving you his story now. And down on Avenue A and B and all through there were living hippies who came out of middle class scenes who were down living there, and then there were Puerto Ricans who were living there. And the hippies were saying, man, wow, this is freedom. And the Puerto Ricans were saying, oh, wow, we got to get out of here. I'm feeding in bits of data that will deal with the problem that you're raising. In Benares, which is the perhaps the holiest city, or at least one of the holiest cities of India, Benares is where people go to die, because if you die there, you get off the wheel, you finish with your karma just by dying in Benares. You get burned at the burning ghat over the Ganga, and you get thrown, your body, your bones get thrown into the Ganges River. And Krishna is there too, with Kali dances, and it's all instant. Before I went, when I was on the Land Rover part of my trip, I went to Benares, and I took LSD in Benares. And I walked down by the burning ghat, and here were all these people, like you'd find a man. This is the way he was moving through the street, right? People with leprosy, people with the worst deformities, the old people, and many of them had these little sacks where they had enough money to pay for the wood for their burning. Or they were begging for that money, for that wood. Now, when I was high, I couldn't look these people in the eye, because it was very powerful. They had nothing to hide. They were so there. I mean, it was like too much of a confrontation for me, for some reason. And it all looked very horrible to me at that point. I was in the Land Rover at a good hotel, and, you know, and I wanted to, I couldn't look them in the eye because I had some traveler's checks left, you know. And they were saying, here we are, and this is it. And I was like playing like, here I am, and this is it. But I knew I had these traveler's checks stashed away. You know, I couldn't be straight with them, because to be straight with them meant sharing everything I had with them. Later, when I came back to Benares, after I had been traveling with Bhagwan Das for a while, I began to realize that these people who I was looking at with such pity, pity is the word, were looking at me with pity because they had made it. They were getting close to that place where they were going to get off the wheel. Right? They looked at me as a Westerner, knowing that as a Westerner I wasn't going to be burned at Benares. And this poor guy, he's just in the wheel of life and death. And these people who are my Western mind categorized as suffering, pity, do something, their state of mind just was something unfathomable to me. Now, but then take somebody who is suffering, who says, I'm suffering. And what emotion can it arouse in a conscious being? The only emotion that is left to a conscious being, and this is something you really have to think about because it is most profound, the only emotion left to a conscious being is that of infinite, unbearable compassion. Boss, period. That's it. No pity, no joy, no anger, no I'm in love with you, all gone. Just compassion. Compassion that sees the poignancy of the life process. That of you which truly is you, which is what we're talking about, that inner place, does nothing. It never does anything. It's just there. It's there in its full glory all the time. You are in your body. Your body has certain karma to work out. You will do things in the world as long as you stay in your body. Now, is what you do irrelevant or not? You see, that is where we're dealing, what we're dealing with here. And from the point of view of enlightenment, what you do there is only one direction that I understand, and that is you work for your enlightenment and the enlightenment of others. And anything that fits into that mold is suitable. It's what's called in Buddhist terms right livelihood or right action. Right action, okay? Now, that may come in strange packages, right? And, for example, for a long time I was a therapist, a psychotherapist, and I used to love my patients so much. Man, I couldn't give them enough. You know, I felt so sorry for them. They were suffering so. And I was just like the Jewish mother, you know. Oh, you know, I'd see you in the middle of the night if you need me. I'm here all the time. Well, what we had was the most neurotic, symbiotic relationship, you know. I mean, I needed them as much as they needed me. And the question of whether I wasn't nurturing their dependency, you know. I mean, what I do now with a person who wants to get straight is all I do is I sit and I do my thing, see, and I stay in my place, and out of that place, then I can help them. Because there's no me that cares. I gotta not care before I can do anything that can really help them. Before I'm not just creating more of my own desire.
Say you and I do the same, we do the same thing.
Yeah.
And I do it because it makes me feel important. You do it out of a feeling of compassion. Okay, that I can see. But it seems to me with the attitude of moksha, which I define as having a maximum of concern with a minimum of attachment, there's a tendency to not care.
Yeah, well, not caring, that's interesting.
Not caring in the sense of being indifferent.
Yes, right, exactly. Well, now, I've been dealing with that because I have a lot of these young kids that come to visit me up at my cabin from the local area in New Hampshire. And when I talk about non-attachment, they say, sure, man, it doesn't matter. And when I hear it, I get all uptight because when they say it, it sounds like they don't give a damn.
Right.
Right? And unbearable compassion, you got to understand what that means. That means you are part of it all. You're doing all the suffering. You're experiencing all the pain. Compassion means you are, the compassionate smile of the Buddha is a full understanding of all the suffering from inside. It's not non-involvement in the sense, it's non-attachment, but not non-involvement. He's very involved, he's just not attached. You see that? And it is true that it is often used as a rationalization, you know, the philosophical position of non-attachment, for it doesn't matter what I do, but you realize that that is a desire. You've got to see the game, the way the game works. That to say, the hell with you, is part of my desires. And therefore, I'm creating karma for myself when I do that. And all I'm doing is creating more sorrows, more troubles for myself for lives to come by doing that. Right? And I'm also keeping you separate from me, which is slowing down my own liberation as well as yours. You see that? So that I would share with you the feeling that at the level of intellect or mind, when a person says, the hell with it, it doesn't matter, it's a very different thing from the compassionate non-attachment that we're talking about. Because, like, let's say somebody is suffering because they're about to die, right? Now, what can you feel? From where I'm sitting, you know, what's so big about dying, man? It's just a change of, you know, your energy form. It's not a big deal. But you try explaining that to a Westerner, right? You know, I'm going to die, man. I mean, it's one thing for you to talk about, but I'm going to die, right? Now, what can you feel for them? See, you can feel, all you can feel is compassion. You can't lie, and you can't, I don't feel any pity for them. I mean, I don't know what pity is. I mean, pity is just another ego game on my part. All I can feel is compassion. And I can try to be straight with them. I can try to be completely straight with them. In other words, I always try to be there at the level of as much consciousness as I can muster. That's what I can do for another human being. All we can do for another human being is be. The doing is not us. The doing is done. And what you do is learn to tune in on the harmonies of the universe and then do what is called for. You float downstream, in this sense. And if that requires you going out and helping somebody who is suffering, you do it. But it is no different an act than you going to the movies from where you're sitting, because you're doing it without attachment. It's a hard one from social, to deal with the issue of social responsibility from, and compare it with the issue of enlightenment, because social responsibility is primarily thought of in the West as an ego trip. It is an ego trip. I am a good person. I do good things. It's the good and evil level. And you have got to realize that enlightenment has nothing to do with good and evil. I was sitting in the woods and I thought, one day I woke up, I've written a thing, I didn't bring it over with me, but I've written a thing and it says, I was sitting here this morning and the sun was streaming in the window in this peaceful valley and I was just feeling great bliss and contentment, and I thought, I was reading from the Bhagavad Gita about the battles and doing battles without being attached to the fruits of the battle, and I thought, well, my battle is the battle of consciousness, and at this moment it's raging, the police versus the hippies and this versus that and so on, back in an airplane. What am I doing here? What is this valley? Am I copping out? Is this a rear-line re-education camp? Is this some kind of a Am I frightened? What is it I'm doing here? You know, how can I justify? Because I feel like I'm a very socially responsible human being. How can I justify this in relation to that? And I remember when Allen Ginsberg called me to help organize the spring mobilization march a couple of years ago, and I said, Allen, I can't do that because I can't march without attachment. I'm not ready to do it. I'm not conscious enough. Maybe you are, but I'm not. And if I march with anger, then I'm just creating anger. I can't do it. Because I can't justify that that's a good act. I'm not sure about what that means. Now, I thought about that and how everybody was down on me for doing that and, you know, very bad, very bad. And then I realized that the battle that I was fighting was the battle that everybody is fighting, was the battle inside of an individual, not outside. And it didn't matter what you were doing outside. You're still confusing the internal and the external issues. Whether you go to a retreat or don't go to a retreat is irrelevant as far as the thing we're talking about. This is orthogonal to it. It's indifferent to it. Your job all the time is to be becoming, because if you look at it, if you look at the history of mankind, you realize that the history of mankind is the history of consciousness, of the conscious beings. That the changes, the major leaps of mankind have been made by the more conscious beings. And that Gurdjieff is absolutely right, and these people have talked about it, that what we are doing is increasing the sum of human consciousness that's available. I mean, you can look now at the nuclear things and all, and the inadequacy of the minds of the people that are running governments to deal with the problems that are unfolding before them. I mean, you can see our government is a reactive government. It doesn't have wisdom. It's just reacting to crisis after crisis. What happened to all the old wise men that used to hang around governments and advise the president, you know, old men that were, you know, because there's no respect for the aged in our culture. See? Right. Now, what is that wisdom we're talking about? That wisdom is the higher consciousness that comes partly from experience, and that's why old men in some cultures are respected. It comes from the broader vision, the more cosmic understanding, right? Now, what do you want to do for your fellow man? Do you want to just get embroiled in the game at the level at which it's being played, and all you do is trade punch for punch? No. See, that, when you look at, like, you take a people that are active in the liberal movement, like the McCarthy people and so on, I stood in front of the Boston Hilton Hotel watching a parade, a protest against Hubert Humphrey with placards and things like that. And I watched the police arrive and I watched the thing develop, and all I saw were two sides equally attached to their game, equally creating the need for the other. There was no doubt about it at all. And you say, is that conscious behavior? That isn't conscious as far as I can see. And that's just perpetuating. It may look good because it's in a pretty colored clothing. And it may say words like peace. I want peace. The way you express peace is by being a peaceful human being. No matter how much bloodshed there is, you create no more peace by protesting against the bloodshed. Even if you have to go to Vietnam and die doing it. That's the point. That's the point.
You know,
you can only teach by being. That's all you can be.
Isn't whatever he does okay, provided he goes to Benares and dies there? You know, plus you automatically get off, or don't you believe that? How much authority does that have?
Well, I'll tell you. It isn't quite works. Doesn't quite work that way. I guess it's a little unfair to say. Whatever you've done, it is true. Whatever you've done, but you—I don't know.
Of course, what you said before seemed to imply that, you know, previous karma not was.
That is true. That's true. At the moment of death, no matter how much of a sinner you've been, that's true. Exactly. I have to say that's true. It doesn't matter what he does. If he goes to Benares and dies, and if he doesn't go to Benares and dies, it just means he'll go on and on living out his karma.
But how much authority does that have? The notion of dying in Benares. Where does that get its authority?
Well, Authority in India is an interesting issue because most of the stuff comes from the Vedas and from the holy books of India, which are written by realized beings. And therefore, it's people who see and therefore know. Right?
And they say this.
And they say this, yes.
Another thing, earlier you mentioned, you said you'd say more later about Mayor Baba.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would like to just finish this run through the Ashtanga Yoga. I don't feel that I have completely resolved this issue with you.
Well, the issue I think is this, simply that in the East, most of the Easterns, although this is a gross simplification I know, feel that they can, if they wait long enough, they'll be able to starve evil, and I hate that word, out, and that they don't have to play. So you don't have to play these people's game on their level, as you put it, which was a good way of putting it. But, and once I would have agreed with you, but now I'm not so sure, because for instance, in the student riots at Columbia, the students have gotten what they want, and it seems they only get what they want these days through violence. I mean, the system has become so insensitive.
It's very interesting of what they got. See, you know, it really is interesting what they got, what the Negroes are getting. Because what you can't measure it that quickly. You can't measure it that quickly.
Well, I'm assuming what I'm reading.
Well, no, you can read it all, and you can say they got all of the rights they wanted at Columbia.
No, not all. They got.
Well, all right.
But they got something.
Yeah, but what else happened along the way? I mean, is for example, is there an inevitable civil war appearing in the United States because everybody is getting what they want by the means they know how, which is violence.
But if no other way works, what then?
Well, you see, the business of works is the question, and works involves that is the Western method of measuring in terms of the external criteria. And you have got to understand that unless we end up with more peaceful human beings inside, then all of the peace efforts, unless we end up with more liberal human beings inside, all the liberalness efforts, unless we end up with more contentment inside, all of the ideas for economic liberation are meaningless.
Okay, I agree.
They're absolutely meaningless. And all you see is that the nature of the human beings in the West is getting what you would call, from most vantage points, more and more ugly. More and more ugly. So that who's getting what? You know, it's like you win the battle and lose the war, you see. And you dig, you don't know where to get in to do it until you understand that each man's job is to work on himself. Because until you're a pure vehicle for truth and for consciousness, anything you do may be doing just the opposite of what you thought it was doing, which is the good case with the whole business of violence in a lot of the movements, because they are creating the conditions of violence. When I first met the guru, I couldn't see him often enough. And now, I think, because that place where I can go inside of myself is the place where he is, where that of him, which I really know is, I don't really ever care whether I see him again in the flesh. It would be nice, and I'll love it, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's not an attachment in that sense. The blanket, sure, I've got a lot of things that are what trivial attachments. You know as well as I do that I love the blanket because I'm having a hard struggle being in the West, because I forget so often, and little things like that help remind me. To that extent, I am attached to the things that help me on my journey, knowing that ultimately, before I finish my journey, I must give up all these things. I've got to give up the attachment to them. In other words, I'm not ready to give you this blanket, my security blanket. And yet, I understand what you're saying. And most of the people, there's a very interesting expression in India. See, there are three gunas in nature. There is tamas, rajas, and sattvic. And tamas is ignorance and darkness and all kinds of dark and horrible things. And rajas is action, and sattvic is purity. And when you have done a lot of work in many incarnations, you free yourself, you purify, and you get further and further freer so that you're more and more sattvic, and you become a very sattvic person, a very pure person. You have met many in the West. They're good people. We call them good people. You know, they do good things. They're a good person. They're good in their human relations and all. And the expression in India is that for most people, they are bound to the world by an iron chain. A sattvic person is bound to the world by a golden chain. It's golden, but it's still a chain. And this is part of the problem of the thing we were talking about, too.
Yeah.
That the attachment to good and evil is still an attachment. And surrounding a guru are always many people who are very good people, you know, that hang out around temples, you know. But they still have a long way to go, you know, probably many lifetimes to go, because they can't get, they're addicted to being good. It really is, and it's addiction. It's an addiction. But there's an awful lot of fraudulence in India. I mean, out of the 10 million sadhus, probably 3/4 of them are fake. At least, I'm being very Christian in my estimate. Whatever that means. Okay, let me finish a few of these little things I've been left hanging around. So the study, you read the books of realized people, and I was about to say, when you raised your hand, that in the West, we tend to read, say you read a book by a guy who's read a book by a realized being. Well, let's say you come to hear me, see, and I'm not a realized being, we all know that, but I'm on the journey. Well, that's a nice thing, that's like the golden chain, you know, I could be on the journey for the next 50 lives, why aren't I just doing it? What am I doing talking to you? Why not, you know, like, I'm doing it, but that's, you know. How many levels can we work at once? It's only words.
WBAI New York.
But maybe there is some very deep flaw in my strategy of doing my sadhana, which is so subtle that I am not conscious of it, and I can't get hold of it. I'm like Typhoid Mary, because what I'm really conveying to you is my own perception of how it is, and I'm selling you the whole thing, which is the reason why I'm not enlightened. You understand that? Therefore, every time you read a book by somebody who is telling you about enlightened people. See, that's why they say you can only read books by enlightened people, right? You can only read books by people who made it, because they're speaking from that other place, and then if they bothered to write a book, see, and then the question is, well, why'd they write a book? And you go, that holds, that's another thing. So you can read Ramana Maharshi, or usually they're the sayings of realized beings that have been written down. Ramana Maharshi, Ramakrishna, Buddha, Christ. And there are many such beings. Mahababa is a realized being. Now, these writings are very, very helpful, extremely helpful. Even if you just read a paragraph a day, because they definitely remind you of the perceptual point from inside looking out, from the place you're trying to get to. Very useful, extremely useful. Now there is one called tapas in niyama, which means austerities. But you've got to remember, it's got to be austerities which aren't austere. And that whole living in the temple, which when you come back and you tell Westerners, and I had a blanket and I slept on the floor and I washed in the river and I ate one meal, oh, they say, oh, and they, you poor thing, and oh, what suffering you've gone through. And inside it's just such a joke because it makes no difference. It makes no difference. There's no suffering. What's that about? It's just like living in the Hilton. There's no difference. And so it's got to be austerities that aren't austere. You've got to be, it's got to be a joyous adventure or the hell with it. I mean, just go another couple of hundred lives, you know. It's going to be that miserable. You're too attached to the misery to get on with it, so why bother? This is not a masochist delight, you know, no matter how masochistic it sounds to somebody who labels the world as masochistic. Now there is one that's called surrender to God, and here I must digress for a moment to talk about bhakti yoga. In the West, we have gone through such a bad trip about religion because religion has become a major social institution in our culture, pretty much devoid of spiritual content. That is, the power of the Spirit, that which Christ said, and the Spirit descended into them, is not very clearly in evidence in most of the leaders of Western religions at the moment. That's the most charitable way I can say what I have to say. Right? And you read the words of Christ and you realize there is a very high yogi speaking. I mean, there's a guy that really knew. And it's very funny because when this winter, when I read the Old Testament, the New Testament, you come across things like, and the Red Sea parted, and he withered the fig tree, and, you know, all those things. And had you but faith, you could move mountains. Now I'm living in a world in India where they say, sure, of course. And so suddenly the Bible, which used to be a nice allegory, a good book to give me examples of that somebody made up to teach me something. It's true. I mean, yogis do those things, you see. Those powers are available to human beings. But in the West, the model that religion sells is, all you can do is pray, and then if you're good at the end of life, when you die, you can go to a place called heaven. And I'll tell you about heaven in a second. And if you're bad, you go to hell, which is the polar of that. And you can't do it during your lifetime. They don't sell that. They don't sell enlightenment during life. And furthermore, it pretty well is agreed that nobody's been enlightened since the Bible. For example, you take the internal prayer of the heart, which we'll get to. I can do it right in Christianity, show you the issue. Let's compare Greek Orthodox Christianity and Western Christianity. Western Christianity has, I was with, 2 days ago, I was with a girl who has been a very high nun. She's a Mother Superior for some 10, 12 years. She's an old girlfriend of mine. She married a higher yogi. And I explored with her the attitude towards Christian mysticism, mystics. Of course, there were many, Teresa and so on, many. And they are reasonably well relegated to either the concerns of very monastic sects within Christianity, or they are treated again as teaching examples. They are not presented as living examples of something a person aspires to in this life. All of this stuff is available, always has been in the West, you understand. This is nothing unique to the East. It's just that there is a different kind of zeitgeist or a different kind of acceptance. In the little village I was living in, everybody believes in miracles, right here and now. You find a village around here where everybody believes in miracles. I mean, when I went around saying, do you know what the guru did? He told me I ate biscuits in Delhi. Oh, of course, man. Let me tell you the story that happened to me last week. Right? See, that's the difference, that you're living in a culture where they are ready to hear about this, and that gives you a lot of support for it happening and for you not rejecting the thing happening inside yourself. Now, let me compare what happened, because the Greek Orthodox Church, which recognizes, for example, the writings of Christian fathers who were mystics and recognizes them and builds them directly into the religion, uses a book called the Philokalia. In fact, many of you may have seen a book called Way of the Pilgrim, which is a delightful book describing a pilgrimage into the inner place using just the simple prayer, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me. Now let me explain to you what this whole business is about of bhakti and mantra and saying a thing like that. The way it really works is you start out and you say it, and you're saying it with your mouth and your lips and words. And then as you keep saying it after like a few days or a week or something like that, you start to hear it being said all the time inside yourself, and you don't have to keep repeating it with your lips. But that's still only part way home. And then finally, it starts to move and you start to feel it happening inside what you would call it your heart area. And this is not just suggestion. I must argue very strongly that Ramana Maharshi's things about the heart and all of the people who have located the source of consciousness is anahata, that chakra, are probably correct, because that is the place where you end with this very powerful feeling. And it becomes, here's what you're doing. Now I'll talk as a psychologist for a second. You use bhakti yoga, or you use what's called Dwight as opposed to Advait, or dualism as opposed to monism. You use there's me, the servant, or he who prays, or the lover, and there is the beloved. You use that as a vehicle into the unitive state. At the point where you finish, where it works, you become one with the thing you worship or pray to. In other words, it's a device. It's another device. These are all what in psychology are called heuristics. They are devices for changing your cognitive map, for changing the things you think about, for changing the types of association patterns that your mind has that you are working with every day. Now I'll give you an example. When I sit down to eat,